Ancient initiation practices would affect all these responses, since it gives a new wound, or gives a calculated wound sufficiently pungent and vivid, though minor, so that the young man remembers his inner wounds. The initiation then tells the young man what to do with wounds, both the new and the old. The old men tell the boys stories as soon as they enter the men's world. If we have no story, we cannot take a hold of our own wound. We either climb above it, so far up that we can't reach down to take a hold of the wound, or we become the wound, get stepped on by something so huge we see only the ground below us. The ancient practice of initiation, then, still very much alive in our genetic structure, offers a third way through. A mentor, or, quote, male mother, unquote, enters the landscape. Behind him, a person of impersonal intensity stands, which in our story is the wild man, or Iron John. The young man investigates or experiences his wound, father wound, mother wound, shaming wound, in the presence of this independent, timeless, mythological, initiatory being. If the young man steals the key and climbs onto the shoulders of this being, three things will change. The wound, rather than being regarded as bad luck, will be seen as a gift. Second, the sacred or secret water, whatever that is, will appear. Finally, the energy of the sun will somehow be carried into the man's body. The wild man in our story takes the boy to a sacred spring to water. We note that golden fish and gold snakes swim in this water. Mythologically, this is the old sacred spring guarded by the wild man and sometimes by the wild woman as well. If this spring is ever polluted, the old Celtic stories say, then everything on the earth will die. So the water is an important place. Psychologically, this is the water of soul life, but only for those ready to go in. Those working with alcoholic families in the last 10 years have made much of the word denial, and it's a good word. Denial stands for amnesia, forgetfulness, oblivion. An ocean of oblivion sweeps over a child when it is shamed. Denial means we have been entranced. We live for years in a trance. Being brought to the water by a mentor means the end of enchantment. The wild man's water does not itself heal the wound that led to escape or to ascension, but it gives strength to the part of us that wants to continue the effort to gain courage and to be human. When Iron John takes the boy to the water, the energy of the sun is somehow carried into the young man's body. The story says it this way. Without intending to, he dipped it into the water. He pulled it out instantly, but he saw that the finger had turned to gold. Gold all over the world suggests a sun glory, royal power, self-generating radiance, freedom from decay, immortality, spiritual luminosity, and it is that gold which has come to the boy's finger. By arranging the surprise of the golden fingertip, the wild man, acting as a spiritual guide here, gives the promise. The promise is a rediscovery, we could say, a rediscovery of a gold that was always there. We do not laboriously, by hard labor in grade school, accumulate a store of sun energy in the spirit warehouse. The gold was in us while we were in the womb. Psychologically, what is the gold in the finger? The story says that when we're in the presence of either a mentor or the wild man, a hint will come to us as to where our genius lies. An artist feels a curious mood of intensity when he or she is working on an art object, a poem, or a painting, or a sculpture. We could say that the sacred pond is right there in the studio, and the artist becomes capable of thoughts and feelings much wilder than he or she ever experiences in shut-down days. The fingers holding the pen or the brush turn gold, and we suddenly see amazing images and realize what we are really good at. The wound that hurts us so much that we involuntarily dip it in the water, we have to regard as a gift. How would the boy in our story have found out about his genius if he had not been wounded? Those with no wounds are the unluckiest of all. Of course, one can't even think that, because no such person has ever been found. But men are taught over and over when they are boys that a wound that hurts is shameful. A wound that stops you from continuing to play is a girlish wound. He who is truly a man keeps walking, dragging his guts behind him. Our story gives a teaching diametrically opposite. It says that where a man's wound is, that is where his genius will be. Wherever the wound appears in our psyches, whether from alcoholic father, shaming mother, shaming father, abusing mother, whether it stems from isolation, disability, or disease, that is precisely the place from which we will give our major gift to the community. Now, let's return to the story. We are leaving our time now. We are leaving our time now. There are seven oceans on this planet. We are going now to the eighth ocean. Early the next morning, the boy sat again at the spring watching over it. His finger still hurt, and after a while, he ran his hand up through his hair. One hair, alas, came loose from his head and fell into the spring. He immediately reached down and pulled it out, but the hair had already turned to gold. The moment Iron John returned, he knew what had happened. Ah, you've let a hair fall into the spring. I'll allow it this time, but if it happens a third time, it will dishonor the spring, and you will not be able to stay with me any longer. We could say that the boy in our story has elevated his wounded finger this time. And that's a little different from dipping it. First, a man dips his wound, one could say, into psychological water, and then he elevates it into mythological space. Wounds need to be expanded into air, lifted up on ideas our ancestors knew, so that the wound ascends through the roof of our parents' house, and we suddenly see how our wound, seemingly so private, fits into a great and impersonal story. Mythology helps to give weight to our private wounds. To feel the wound in a particular part of our body gives our wound weight, and to understand it as a part of an ancient story gives it weight. Without the weight given by a wound consciously realized, the man will lead a provisional life. The wounded finger this time gets associated with hair. Hair covers the wild man and the wild woman, as we know from many sources. The question of hair comes up a lot in this story. When we look for cultural associations with the word hair, we notice at least four linkages. The first is the sexual energy. When a young Roman woman joined the Vestal Virgins, the other women ritually shaved her head. Monks during the Middle Ages were tonsured, and Orthodox Jewish women to this day wear wigs to hide their own hair. Because animals exhibit hair in profusion, and because we see our own sexuality as animal, that linkage is unavoidable. Hunters traditionally wear long hair, as do the animals that they hunt. Hair, then, can stand for animal life in general, particularly the life of wild animals. Hair suggests not only closeness to animals through hunting or domestication, but it suggests all forms of animal hot-bloodedness. Reptiles, cold-blooded, lack hair, and so hair comes to represent that passionate, flaring nature peculiar to mammals. Hot tempers, redheads, fiery temperaments, passionate impulsiveness, spontaneity, explosive emotions, leonine fierceness, tigerish jealousy. Finally, hair suggests excess. The hairiness of Enkidu, the Babylonian wild man, or Pan, the goat man, suggests that hair stands for what is beyond the boundaries of all middle-of-the-road civilization. Pan is outside the enclosure. When the boy in our story, then, inadvertently dislodges one hair that falls into the spring, and it turns to gold, we could say that he learns these things. That sexual energy is good, that the hunting instinct, which mammals possess without shame, is good. That animal heat, fierceness, and passionate spontaneity is good. And that excess, extravagances, and going with Pan out beyond the castle boundaries is good, too. We'll continue the story now with the third day. We're leaving our time once more. We're going to a time before time appeared on the clock faces. before it appeared on our wrists. The third day, as the boy sat by the spring, he was determined, no matter how much his finger hurt him, not to let it move. Time passed slowly, and he began gazing at the reflection of his face in the water. He got the desire to look straight into his own eyes. And in doing this, he leaned over farther and farther. All at once, his long hair fell down over his forehead and into the water. He threw his head back. But now all his hair, every bit, had turned gold, and it shone as if it were the sun itself. Now the boy was frightened. He took out a kerchief and covered his head so that the wild man wouldn't know what had happened. But when Iron John arrived home, he knew immediately. "Take the kerchief off your head," he said. The golden hair then came tumbling down over the boy's shoulders, and the boy had to be silent. In our story, the boy's hands now remain behind his back. It isn't the hands that reach out now, but the eyes. The eyes began to search around him, their curiosity perhaps intensified by the intimation that gold is everywhere, mysteriously present even in clear water. He focuses on his own face, finally on his own eyes. We know that shame often keeps us from meeting other people's eyes, or our own. But when we do look into our own eyes, whether we do that staring into a mirror or into a pond surface, we have the inescapable impression, so powerful and astonishing, that someone is looking back at us. The person who gazes in the mirror receives an awareness of his other half, his shadow, or hidden man. Awareness of that hidden man is a proper aim for all initiation. The experience teaches him that the eyes he sees are not just him, but some other man, not included very well under the name his parents gave him. The one looking back is at the same time a man's shadow, or dark side, but also his spiritual twin, his white shadow. Rolf Jacobsen, the Norwegian poet, calls him, "Your shadow, the white one, whom you cannot accept, and who will never forget you." The Gnostics spoke a great deal about the twin, whom they imagined to have been separated from us at birth. The twin retains the spiritual knowledge given us before birth. The twin, when he or she re-enters the psyche, insists on intensity and seriousness. In our story, there is no mirror. The mirror is made by nature, or more exactly, it is nature. We could say that the boy in our story has seen eyes looking back at him from nature. The story implies that we, as human beings, are not the only source of ordered intelligence and conscious awareness. The eyes in the water can be regarded as an emblem of the consciousness in nature, the intelligence out there. We could sum up by saying that when a man has received a glimpse of his own psychic twin, and when he has seen the intelligence in nature, its consciousness or intent, then that man's hair turns gold. He has a golden head. We note that the boy in our story seems very young to have a golden head. We gather from the way he hides it under the kerchief that he feels it is not proper and right to show it. 3 days have now passed in ritual time. These 3 days could be 15 years in our time. The initiator gives the boy a task, and he failed at it 3 times. But he receives a gift anyway each time. The failures rose from the pain he felt and from his human inability to keep attention, but the gift came from the water, with whom he has somehow established a relationship. We deduce that accepting an initiatory task is more important than succeeding or failing at it. We would guess that the boy has done all right. If we return to the story now, we hear Iron John's final words after the 3 days at the pond. Iron John says, "You can't stay here any longer because you didn't make it through the trial. Go out into the world now, and there you will learn what poverty is. I see no evil in your heart, however, and I wish you well, so I give you this gift. Whenever you are in trouble, come to the edge of the forest and shout, 'Iron John!' Iron John, Iron John. I'll come to the edge of the forest and help you. My power is great, greater than you believe, and I have gold and silver in abundance. We're moving into a new section of the story soon, and we might look back on the boy's progress so far. The king's son, in following the wild man, has not gone the way of delinquency, drug addiction, and self-shaming. On the contrary, he has been lifted up to what is great in him. It is as if his teacher in high school had been Pablo Casals, who taught him what genius is, and by commenting on the gold tip of his finger, convinced him that he had some. He also learned to trust his instinctual body, or hair. And finally, he sees eyes looking back at him from the water, and by extension, looking at him from the grass, the trees, the mountains. He learned that the whole world is on fire. As Pythagoras said, everything is intelligent. All of his hair turns gold. Such teaching can have strange effects. If such good luck happened to one of us, a friend would probably warn us that we are in danger of becoming overly grand. Young men, when lifted up, may become white swans, grandiose ascenders, flying boys, just as young women, similarly lifted up, may become flying girls. These flying people, giddily spiritual, do not inhabit their bodies well, and are open to terrible shocks of abandonment. They are unable to accept limitations and are averse to a certain boring quality native to human life. We need to add that not all young men are ascenders. Some are earthbound, take on responsibility too early, commit themselves to supporting others. They walk slowly, move close to the ground, carry enormous burdens, feel they have no right to look even at slivers of sunlight. Their family tradition is that the son's grandiosity is to be wiped out early. Sometimes in those families, the women are the inflated ones, and the men are not. Men take the depressed road. They do not become artists or musicians. Their life takes place where the soles of their shoes touch the ground. Some fairy tales call them shoemakers, and they note the tension between them and what the fairy tales call tailors. The boy in our story is at the moment of ascension now. As such, he's similar, for better or worse, to millions of men and women in American culture now. We have to look very carefully at these ascenders, these tailors or flyers, if we are going to make any change in men and women's lives, and we might look at them in the light of three words: passivity, naivete, and numbness. We know that for hundreds of years, men have admired each other and been admired by women, in particular, for their activity. Men and women alike once called on men to pierce the dangerous places, carry handfuls of courage to the waterfalls, dust the tails of the wild boars. All know that if men did that well, the women and children could sleep safely. Now the boars have turned to pigs in the stockyard, and the rushing rivers to the waterfall in the Museum of Modern Art courtyard. The activity men were once loved for is not required. During the last 30 years, men have been asked to learn how to go with the flow, how to follow rather than lead, how to live in a non-hierarchical way, how to be vulnerable, how to adopt consensus decision-making. Some women want a passive man if they want a man at all. The church wants a tamed man. They're called priests. The university wants a domesticated man. They're called tenure-track people. The corporation wants a team worker, and so on. William Blake roots passivity in earliest childhood. Struggling in my father's hands, striving against my swaddling bands, bound and weary, I thought best to sulk upon my mother's breast. The infant boy struggles against the father's hands, fighting the narcissistic father's desire to bind or murder him. And he struggles against swaddling bands, fighting the narcissistic mother's desire to change him to what she wants. When the boy fails to get free, then, Blake says, he learns to sulk, How often every adult man has felt himself, when baffled by a woman's peculiar interpretation of his behavior, so different from his own, go into a sulk. In such a mood, screaming, shouting, kvetching never appear. These are too active. When a man sulks, he becomes passive to his own hurts. When no old men appear to break the hold of the sulking infant, the habit of passivity spreads to other parts of his life. The passive man, for example, may ask the woman to do his loving for him. Talking is not everything, but it is a part of loving, as are buying gifts, getting to completion, as they say, in a conversation, praising the other person, keeping the thread of intimacy unbroken. Maggie Scarfe remarks in Intimate Partners that 3/4 or so of American marriages follow a curious scenario. The woman wants more intimacy and the man flees from that. She runs after, but not quite fast enough to catch him. And he flees, but not quite fast enough to get away. This game can go on for years. The passive man may not say what he wants, and the girlfriend or wife has to guess it. As a compensation for passivity at home, he may go into robot production at work, but that isn't really what he wants either. We see more and more passivity in men, but also more and more naivete. The word special is important to the naive man, as he has special relationships with certain people whose dark side he never investigates. The naive man loves sincerity and assumes it should and will protect him from consequences of his acts. The naive man will lose what is most precious to him because of a lack of boundaries. He tends as well to have an inappropriate relation to ecstasy, finding great mother ecstasies very easy. Finally, the naive man often doesn't know that there's a being in him that wants to remain sick. The naive man in general feels a pride in being attacked. If his wife or girlfriend, furious, shouts that he is a chauvinist, a sexist, a man, he opens his shirt so she can see more clearly where to put the lances. He ends with 3 or 4 javelins sticking out of his chest and blood all over the floor. He feels, as he absorbs attacks, that he is doing the brave and advanced thing. He will surely be able to recover somewhere in isolation. The naive man will also be proud that he can pick up the pain of others. He particularly picks up women's pain. In general, I think each gender drops its own pain when it tries to carry the pain of the other gender. I don't mean that men shouldn't listen, but hearing a woman's pain and carrying it are two different things. Women have tried for centuries to carry men's pain, and that hasn't worked well. We have talked of passivity and naivete, and now we'll add the third word, numbness. A spiritual man may love light and yet be entirely numb in the chest area. I'll set down a personal fable. When I was 2 or 3 years old, I went to my father and I asked him for protection. But he was an intense man, and being with him felt more dangerous than being out in the street. I then went to my mother and I asked her for protection. At the instant she said yes, I went numb from my neck down to my lower belly. That's the fable. It may not be true. I don't know at what age my numbness came. Perhaps I had a genetic expectation that my father would protect me, and when that didn't happen, I went numb from the shock of it. It's also possible that I knew, or thought I knew, that if I accepted my mother's protection, I would have to learn to feel as a woman feels. But I was a man, and so I decided, rather than that, to have no feelings at all. The fable does suggest that a mother's protection, no matter how well-intentioned, will not do as a substitute for the father's protection. My chest area remained numb up to and through high school. My head was fiery and full of blood, and my genitals were fiery and curious too. The area in between was the problem. In high school, a girl might ask, do you love me? I couldn't answer. If I asked her the same question, she might reply, well, I respect you, and I admire you, and I'm fond of you, and I'm even interested in you, but I don't love you. Apparently, when she looked into her chest, she saw a whole spectrum of affections, a whole procession of feelings, and she could easily tell them all apart. If I looked down into my chest, I saw nothing at all. I had then either to remain silent or fake it. Some women feel hurt when a man will not, in quotation marks, express his feelings, unquote, and they conclude that he's holding back, or telling them something by such withholding. But it's more likely that when such a man asks a question of his chest, he gets no answer at all. Some of that numbness is gone in me now. I can answer questions about my feelings, and I can see people down there with different colored robes walking around and tell one from the other. It's possible that as a man gets older, certain numb parts of his body naturally come to life. It's also possible that the numbness moves away as we learn to go to other people besides our parents for protection. If the golden boy in our story is an ascender and a flyer after he leaves the spring, then Ion John is quite correct when he says to the boy in essence, "You know a great deal about gold now, but nothing about poverty." In effect, he says, "You know a lot about going up and nothing about going down." And this is the way the story talks about his leaving the spring. We are leaving our time now. We are going to a place where time moves more slowly. Then the king's son left the forest, and he walked by beaten and unbeaten paths, ever onwards, until at last he reached a great city. And there he looked for work, but could find none. And he had learned nothing by which he could help himself. At length he went to the palace and asked if they would take him in. The people about court did not at all know what use they could make of him, but they liked him and they told him to stay. At length the cook took him into his service, and said that he might carry wood and water and rake the cinders together. The king's son is going to experience something completely different now. To fall from being a king's son to being a cook is the step the story asks for. Carrying wood and water, working in the basement of the castle where the kitchen is, stands for the drop through the floor, the descent, the humiliation, the way down and out. We find that phrase in George Orwell's title, Down and Out in Paris and London. When Orwell decided to go beyond the naivete he inherited from his middle-class upbringing, he too got a job in the basement, and his novel is full of the underground life of the kitchen help in big hotels. For young men who have graduated from privileged colleges or who have been lifted upward by the expensive entitlement culture, their soul life often begins with this basement work in the kitchen. The way down and out usually separates the young man from his companion flyers and from their support, and makes him aware of a depression that may have been living unnoticed in him for years, a mean life of ordinariness, heaviness, silence, cracks in the road, weightiness, and soberness begins. Our story simply says that after wandering around a while, having no craft, the young man at last got a job in the kitchen, which is traditionally in the basement of a castle. The story says that after all the gold fingertips and hair, what is proper next for the man is the whirlpool, the sinking through the floor, the drop, what the ancient Greeks called katabasis. There is something more than a little frightening about this drop. Our ego doesn't want to do it. And even if we drop, the ego doesn't want to see it. The sounds in katabasis, harsh and abrupt, feel right for this trip. We remember Oedipus and his katabasis. One day an arrogant, demanding king, the next a blind man led around by others. These days, katabasis comes about through addiction, alcohol, cocaine, crack. The man loses his health and ends up with thin legs, flat energy, deprived of wife and children, deprived of friends, house, money. He loses his job, self-respect, quote, in every mark of his former art and life. The way down and out doesn't require poverty, homelessness, physical deprivation, dishwasher work necessarily, but it does seem to require a fall from status, from a human being to a spider, from a middle-class person to a derelict. The emphasis is on the consciousness of the fall. One has the sense that some power in the psyche arranges a severe katabasis if the man does not know enough to go down on his own. Depression is a small katabasis, and something other than us arranges it. Depression usually surprises us by its arrival and by its departure. In depression, we refuse to go down, and so a hand comes up and pulls us down. In grief, we choose to go down. With initiators gone from our culture, we do not receive instruction on how to go down on our own. We could use the phrase, going into grief, for the conscious act of descent. But one sometimes feels that in the United States, a man is supposed to feel grief only at a funeral. Descent or kitchen work can take two other forms. We'll name these as taking the road of ashes and moving from the mother's world to the father's world. Ashes and cinders, in fairy tales, are code words for the ashy, sooty, depressed, out-of-it time. We imagine in our day that to be assigned to the hearth is some sort of punishment, but in the fairy tales, that assignment goes to the lucky third son, who is the magical ashy fool, and to the lucky third daughter. Cinderella, the magical suffering child of the mother, is one. For those children, tending the hearth is the right task. To live the life of ashes is very different from dropping into katabasis. It doesn't require a fall in social status. It is not so explosive. There is something about ashes that is steady, even lethargic. Young men in Viking times, according to the Norwegian scholar R. Kaiser, were allowed sometimes 2 or 3 years of ashes. Norwegians at that time lived in long communal houses, not unlike the long houses of the West Coast Indians. In his book on the Old Norsemen, Kaiser described how 30 or 40 people slept in the beds along the walls. Down the center of the hall, they laid out a pavement which acted as a fireplace. Smoke went up through holes in the roof. Ashes lay in long heaps, 2 or 3 feet from the pavement, between it and the beds. It turned out that young men sometimes would lie down in that space between the fire and the ash pile and stay there 2 or 3 years. According to Kaiser, such as these might constantly be seen crouching over the fire, rolling themselves in the ashes, eating ashes, and neither caring to employ themselves in anything useful, nor to keep themselves in a state of cleanliness. Apparently some also chewed cinders. They were called cinder biters. It's clear that the young men were going through some kind of hibernation or ritual lethargy, and the older men and women allowed it. If a young man now feels the need to drop out of school, there is no ritual for that, and he may easily end up shamed or worse in prison. Kaiser mentions a cinder biter in the 11th century named Starkad, who remained in the ashes several years until his foster father invited him to go on an expedition. At that point, he stood up, shaved and dressed, and became one of the best warriors on the expedition, and later became a distinguished poet as well, remembered in the sagas. Despite our Disneyland culture, some men around 35 or 40 will begin to experience ashes privately, without ritual, even without old men. They begin to notice how many of their dreams have turned to ashes. A young man in high school dreams that he'll be a race driver, a mountain climber, he'll marry Miss America, he'll be a millionaire by 30, he'll get a Nobel Prize in physics by 35, he'll be an architect and build the tallest building ever. He will get out of his hick town and live in Paris. He will have fabulous friends. And by 35, all these dreams are ashes. At 35, his inner stove begins to produce ashes as well. All through his 20s, his stove burned with such a good draft that he threw in whole nights until dawn, drinking parties, sexual extravagance, enthusiasm, madness, excitement. Then one day, he noticed that his stove doesn't take such big chunks anymore. He opens the stove door, and ashes fall out on the floor. It's time to buy a small black shovel at the hardware store and get down on his knees. Franklin Roosevelt found his ashes in his polio, Anwar Sadat in his prison, Solzhenitsyn in the gulag. Some of our liveliest writers, John Steinbeck, William Faulkner, Thomas McGrath, Tilly Olson, David Ignatow, Kenneth Rexroth, found their ashes in the poverty of the Depression. We could say that a man finds katabasis only through dropping, poverty, abrupt change in social class. And prison is a traditional place to experience both katabasis and ashes. But a man may keep his job and family and still experience ashes if he knows what he's doing. When initiation is in place, the old man helped the boys to move from the mother's world to the father's world, and we'll call that the third form of the descent. Boys have lived happily since birth in the mother's world, and the father's world naturally seems to them dangerous, unsteady, and full of unknowns. We recall that most cultures describe the first stage of initiation as a sharp and clean break with the mother. Old men simply go into the women's compounds with spears one day, when the boys are between 8 and 12, and take the boys away. When gender issues, as we call them, are well understood, the women do not oppose the initiatory work with the boys, nor helplessly yearn for it, but participate enthusiastically and sadly in the drama of it. The relevant sentence is the one accepted in New Guinea by men and women of 80 or so tribes. A boy cannot change into a man without the active intervention of the older men. So the first stage, then, is a clean break with the mother. That happens in our story when the wild man takes the boy on his shoulders. But a break is only a break, and it doesn't imply any internal movement inside the boy. All that is still to happen. With most of us, it is still happening. Simply put, the boy needs to move from the mother's house to the father's house. Shakespeare's Hamlet describes with fantastic wit and in heartbreaking detail the difficulty of this move. If no old man or competent initiator is present at this stage, and Polonius certainly is not such a man, all moves slowly. We learn one more thing from Hamlet. A young man cannot make the move to the father's world alone without taking into himself the dark side of the trickster. A man's effort to move to the father's house takes a long time. It's difficult, and each man has to do it for himself. For Hamlet, it meant giving up the immortality or the safe life promised to the faithful mother's son, and accepting the risk of death always imminent in the father's realm. Moving to the father's world does not necessarily mean rejecting the mother or shouting at her. Hamlet is off in that respect, but rather the movement involves convincing the naive boy or the comfort-loving boy to die. We surmise, then, that when a man accepts the descent as a way to move to the father's house, he learns to look at the death side of things, accepts the snake rather than the bird as his animal, increases his tolerance for ashes, and Saturn becomes his god. Saturn helps men to get heavy with the full weight of their wound and the full power of their failures. As I've participated in men's gatherings since the early 1980s, I've heard one statement over and over from American men, which has been phrased in 100 different ways. There is not enough father. The sentence implies that father is a substance like salt, which in earlier times was occasionally in short supply, or like groundwater, which in some areas now has simply disappeared. Geoffrey Gore remarked in his book, The American People, that for a boy to become a man in the United States in 1940, only one thing was required, namely, that he reject his father. He noticed, moreover, that American fathers expect to be rejected. Young men in Europe, by contrast, have traditionally imagined the father to be a demonic being whom they must wrestle with. Many sons in the United States, however, visualize the father as a simple object of ridicule to be made fun of, as in fact he is so often in comic strips and television commercials. One young man summed it up, "A father is a person who rustles newspapers in the living room." Traditional cultures still in existence seem to have plenty of father. In so-called traditional cultures, many substitute fathers work with a young man. Uncles loosen the son up or tell him about women. Grandfathers give him stories. Warrior types teach weaponry and discipline. Old men teach ritual and soul. All of them honorary fathers. Fathers and sons in most tribal cultures live in an amused tolerance of each other. The son has a lot to learn, and so the father and son spend hours trying and failing together to make arrowheads or to repair a spear or track a clever animal. When a father and son do spend long hours together, which some fathers and sons still do, we could say that a substance almost like food passes from the older body to the younger. The contemporary mind might want to describe the exchange between father and son as a likening of attitude, a miming, but I think a physical exchange takes place, as if some substance was passing directly to the cells. The son's body, not his mind, receives and the father gives this food at a level far below consciousness. The son does not receive a hands-on healing, but a body-on healing. His cells receive some knowledge of what an adult masculine body is. The younger body learns at what frequency the masculine body vibrates. It begins to grasp the song that adult male cells sing, and how the charming, elegant, lonely, courageous, half-shamed male molecules dance. When a father absent during the day returns home at 6, his children receive only his temperament and not his teaching. If the father is working for a corporation, what is there to teach? He is reluctant to tell his son what is really going on. The fragmentation of decision-making in corporate life, the massive effort that produces the corporate willingness to destroy the environment for the sake of profit, the prudence, even cowardice, that one learns in bureaucracy, who wants to teach that? No historical models prepare us for the contemporary son's psychic condition. To understand the son's psyche, we have to imagine new furniture, new psychic figures, new demon possessions, new terrors, new incapacities, new flights. Enormous changes have appeared at the last minute. Few of us, fathers or sons, are prepared for such vast changes. I have mentioned so far the young men's father hunger and the starving bodies of the sons. We might look now at the disappearance of positive kings. The patriarchy is a complicated structure. Mythologically, it's matriarchal on the inside, and a matriarchy is equally complicated, being patriarchal on the inside. The political structure has to resemble our interior structure, and we know that each man has a woman inside him, and each woman has a man inside her. The genuine patriarchy brings down the son through the sacred king into every man and woman in the culture, and the genuine matriarchy brings down the moon through the sacred queen into every woman and every man in the culture. The death of the sacred king and queen means that we live now in a system of industrial domination, which is not patriarchy. The system we live in gives no honor to the male mode of feeling nor to the female mode of feeling. The system of industrial domination determines how things go with us in the world of resources, values, and allegiances, what animals live and what animals die, how children are treated, and in the mode of industrial domination, there is neither king nor queen. The death of the sacred king and the disappearance of the group king means that the father shortage becomes still more acute. When a father now sits down at the table, he seems weak and insignificant, and we all sense that fathers no longer fill as large a space in the room as 19th century fathers did. As the father seems more and more enfeebled, dejected, paltry, he also appears to be the tool of dark forces. We remember that in Star Wars we are given an image of Darth Vader upon the Dark Father. He is wholeheartedly on the side of the dark forces. The demons who have set up a propaganda shop in the son's psyche convince him that his father's darkness is deeper than the son ever imagined. What can be done about that? The son finds out early that his mother cannot redeem his father. Moreover, in most cases, she doesn't want to. The only one left to do it is the son. As long as the political kings remain strong, the father picked up radiance from above, and the son tried to emulate the father, to become as bright as he is, to reach to his height. The son perceives the father as bright. Though this may not have been true in reality, we notice that literature as late as the 18th century is full of this sort of deference, this reverence for the father, and emulation. In our time, when the father shows up as an object of ridicule, as he does on television, or a fit field for suspicion, as he does in Star Wars, or a bad-tempered fool, when he comes home from the office with no teaching, or a weak puddle of indecision, as he stops inheriting kingly radiance, the son has a problem. How does he imagine his own life as a man? Some men fall into a secret despair. They have probably adopted, by the time they are 6, their mother's view of their father, and by 20 will have accepted society's critical view of fathers, which amounts to a dismissal. What can they do but ask women for help?